TBRI.
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 TOVD.
TBRI.
TBRI, Trust-Based Relational Intervention.
TBRI is an attachment-based
trauma-informed intervention
that is designed to meet the complex needs
of vulnerable children.
TBRI uses empowering principles
to address physical needs,
connecting principles for attachment needs,
and correcting principles to disarm fear-based behaviors.
While TBRI is based on years of attachment, sensory processing, and neuroscience research,
the heartbeat of TBRI is connection.
Hello, and welcome back to the TBRI podcast. You're listening to Season 5, Episode 3. On this show, we talk all about trust-based relational intervention, or TBRI. We talk about different elements of the model itself, and also about how TBRI is applied in various systems of care and practice. Today, we are chatting with Carrie Dady about TBRI and trauma-informed courts. Carrie earned her Bachelor of Arts from the University of Montana and her Juris Doctor from the University of Washington Law School. Following graduation, Carrie served as an appellate law clerk at Washington State Court of Appeals. She spent several years working as an appellate public defender in Seattle, Washington, before transitioning to civil litigation. She worked with several Seattle law firms before returning to her beloved home state, Montana. After adopting and experiencing the life-changing power of TBRI on a personal level, Carrie shifted her career focus. She became a TBRI practitioner in 2019 and worked with a nonprofit in Montana to equip foster and adoptive families with TBRI tools. She joined the KPICD in 2021 and works on consulting projects across the globe, including the implementation of TBRI in the court systems, which is the focus of our chat today. Oh, friends, this episode is obviously great for folks who are serving in a court, but I think it's a great example of implementing trust-based relationships in a space that may seem countercultural to TBRI. Carrie and our host Sarah chat through some of the really remarkable work that is happening in courts that have embraced TBRI. And here's the thing, they all started with just a few passionate individuals and small changes that yielded big results. We are so excited to share this conversation with KPICD staff member, Carrie Dady.
Carrie Dady, welcome to the pod.
Sarah Mercado, delighted as always to be with you.
Man, it's good to have you on here. This is going to be a really fun conversation. So will you tell us a little bit about your story? How did you get to TBRI? How did you get to the Institute?
It's a funny story. It's a meandering story, Sarah. TBRI as a desperate parent, not as an attorney. Came as a parent. We had three bio kids and thought, wouldn't it be fun to have four kids, two boys, two girls? Adoption is part of my family's story. And so in my mind, it's a really natural way to grow your family. When we adopted 2017, I thought I would have graded myself as a parent A to A plus. Definitely extra credit, good parent, didn't have a lot to learn. And I say that it is incredibly arrogant. It sounds so arrogant, but at the time I'm relying on, do my kids do well in school? Do they get invited to birthday parties? Are social things going well? What is the feedback like from other people in my community? And that was my baseline for how I'm doing as a parent. And all of that was fine. And so I didn't know what I didn't know. Once we welcomed our son into our family in 2017, he was 3 and a half when he joined us, had medical trauma, institutional trauma, food insecurity. I mean, the list of adverse things that happened early in life were long. And within a week, we learned, my husband and I, that everything we knew about parenting that worked and resonated with our bio kids that did not have all that early trauma was not working with our new love bear.
Did he you wasn't say within able- 1 week? Within 1 week, you knew? Well, that's we fast.
Knew. How did you know? Because our formerly, I would say our house with three kids, 50% wild, 50% wonderful. It's a managed circus, but when our son came home, it turned into Fight Club. So fist fight.
Okay. Yeah.
Children, tantrums that lasted hours, tables cleared off, objects flying through our house. And so all of that was new behavior that we hadn't seen in our other kids. And we did not have a great way of responding to that in a way that would calm him down, come alongside him. And so all this love that we longed to pour out, we had been waiting for this baby to get into our home. He couldn't receive, and our home was chaos. It felt like our family was shattered.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so, man.
Yes. Out of that desperation, I found TBRI, not as an attorney. I didn't think at the time it would have any application to my work life, but professionally, it was that time where you are so broken, you are so desperate, you are willing to look at every assumption, every pattern that you hold and say, this is not working. Someone help. And our answer was TBRI.
Yeah. Wow. Really, really incredible. And so once you learned TBRI, was that a bit of a journey? Because I know, like, I had the thing of, like, if my kids say yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am in public, if my kids walk into church and say the recited verse for the week or the memory verse for the week, or, right, like, nobody needed to know what happened on the way to church to make that happen, right? Like, the frustration and the anxiousness and everybody flipping out, like, once we opened the doors to that church, it looked good. And so I know we had a really messy period from trying to learn TBRI to getting into, like, you know, real connected relationship with the girls. But what was that process like? And did your bio children think, like, what on earth just happened to my parents?
Our first exposure to TBRI was hearing Sarah Mercado, Darren Jones, Amanda Purvis at the Empowered Connect conference. And I came as a skeptic, and I hear this in consultation because the elements of TBRI are simple. And I thought we needed some kind of major overhaul. And I was very skeptical that little micro moves could change the trajectory of the chaos that was happening in our family. But I remember Darren Jones walking through correcting principles. He's a master at that. And the memory, the nightly memory came to me of putting our oldest bio kid to bed, which was like, it was like an explosion. It was like a plane crash every night. This kid's favorite thing to do since she was three is reading. And so I would go into her bedroom and do something like, hey, time to go to bed, lights out, now. This child, there is never a great time to stop reading. And so it would always be a back and forth bicker. I didn't know about choices, compromises, giving voice. And so this interaction would escalate every night until I pretty much threw my hands in the air and was like, fine, go to bed whenever you want. Good night. Not loving, not a great end to the day. All of the things that we would hope not to do. And so I remember Darren talking through these correcting principles, and I'm like, this won't work, but I'll give it a try. And so came home that night from the Empowered to Connect conference, and we, you know, we try level one, this playful engagement, blow right through. We get to the level two, we're like, choices, give voice. And in that moment, it was a kid looking at me like, are you for real? Because you usually don't give me voice. You usually don't ask I feel or what I need. And it was, would you like to finish the end of the chapter or 10 more minutes? And Darren had made us, you know, come up with, generate two great solutions that work for you. And it was in the midst of a kid, you know, reading Harry Potter or something that was like, she was like, you get it. I can't end on a cliffhanger. If I'm in the middle of a chapter and I don't know what happens, I just need 8 more minutes so I can calm my body. And so we tried it. And I was shocked that we had a very different interaction with a kid who is impulsive. She's always testing boundaries. She's wild. She's wonderful. There's so many things. But I was like, this is gold. What just happened here?
Right.
And can it work in other places that felt really tricky?
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that story. Wild and wonderful. Sounds like she may have gotten that from her mama. I'm just guessing. I don't know. So switching back, you were an attorney, then you went into nonprofit work, and then you applied at the Institute and were hired. And talk about full circle moment, because for our listeners, if you don't know, Carrie Dady, who was exposed to TBRI through the Empowered to Connect conference, was just on Hope for the Journey, which is now the, you know, what the Empowered to Connect conference is now. So that's a pretty big full circle moment for you. I bet that was a surreal event. Did you think, I'll bring my attorneying work into this job at the Institute? Did that even cross your mind that, like, pretty quickly you kind of slingshot into courts, and how can we help make the courts a better experience for the families that they serve?
Not at all. I thought, okay, moving to TBRI land, I had this moment of, this seems absurd. This, I spent all of this time, money, effort to get this training. I was very passionate about it. I loved being an attorney. But Sarah, when I looked in my state and I was like, okay, what happened in my family is a literal miracle. There are five other people who are trained as practitioners in my state. There's thousands of good to great attorneys. This is the work that heals. I really thought it was a full career pivot. Mm-hmm. I will tell you, I graduated from law school at a time, I mean, it's been a minute since I graduated from law school. Okay. This idea of trauma-informed courts, of looking at this, it wasn't even on anybody's radar. Looking mm-hmm. at trauma was the job of a clinician, a social worker, possibly a nonprofit. And so I had no idea that there had been all of this movement to integrate these two areas, and was surprised, delighted to be catapulted into a space where these two things that I am passionate about align.
You know, I remember one time being in a courtroom in Travis County in Austin where the judge got it, and this girl had like thrown a rock through the window the previous week. And she was so excited to go to court because she knew that she threw a rock through a window, but she didn't throw a rock at somebody's head, and the judge was going to celebrate that as growth. And so it was like being on another planet at the time. And so now to know that the pouring in and the work of the courts and your influence and taking your experience has just really made this thing take off. So let's look at what is a TBRI informed or a courtroom, or a courtroom that looks through the lens of TBRI. How does that look different than a court that doesn't have this influence? And no shame. I mean, it's like you said, like, even though it's been a minute, it takes a long time to get this type of change into, you know, a space that is so rigid and so structured and so riddled with high expectations. And really, I mean, it's not like you said, like, attorneys aren't being trained in trauma, right? They're trained in the law. So let's just take it kind of step by step a little bit. And if you think about a trauma-informed court, let's just look at the empowering principles. Can you give us an example of maybe before TBRI, after TBRI, or an example that you've seen in the courts of how the empowering principles play out, and then how that courtroom looks differently?
This is a great question. I think the core of all, we have beautiful, stunning stories from around the country. There are many judges, many court systems who are committed to being part of the solution rather than continuing what we have always done. How the genesis of this change is always, it's usually a judge, someone who is passionate and has influence to say, that looks holistically at the result and says, we're not doing what we've intended to do. And so maybe we are getting high conviction rates, but the rate of recidivism when these people are back in the community, they're right back in jail. So we haven't actually solved the problem. So one of the elements is we see a judge who is a learner, who is curious, who is wanting to know more, and brings this as a model to their court. The court is such a fantastic learning lab because it is often a smaller closed system, and you have someone who can make changes pretty quickly without a ton of red tape.
Right.
The empowering principles that you mentioned are often the first time, are the first stop in terms of implementation, because it is very low hanging fruit. You will get an easy win, which will then give you momentum and help generate buy-in from skeptics like you and I, who are standing on the outside of the circle saying, this will never work.
What? It's true. It's true.
Okay. So some of the specific things, and again, there are 1,000 ways to start. One really simple, and I'm going to give you simple things that you don't need money to do, or very low cost. Perfect. One of the ideas, oftentimes when a court hearing starts, there are many cases that will be heard, and they're all scheduled to start and appear at 9 a.m. So especially in, maybe you have a dependency case, a child welfare case, a truancy case, there are a lot of people waiting in a really small space. Sometimes if there's a criminal matter at hand, you might have the accused waiting with the victim and all kinds of parties together. Courthouses are not usually luxurious, well-funded spaces. So oftentimes it's a small hallway. There's not enough seats. And so one of the things that some judges have done, and judges do have incredible leniency to do this, is they've started staggered docketing. And so instead of calling 15 cases at 9 a.m., they started calling, you know, 4 at 9 a.m. and 4 at 10:15. The beautiful thing is families were not waiting for hours and hours and hours. And often it was hours without access to food or water. There wasn't even a vending machine available. The other thing that happened when judges have done this is their staff gets a break. These cases are often emotionally charged. There's often just hard fact patterns, which that court staff takes in day after day, and the toll of that secondary trauma. So just something like, we're not going to call 15 cases first in the morning. That might mean that we have little breaks. I mean, the attorney brain is wired for efficiency of let's just go, go, go. But these judges and court systems that implemented staggered docketing really appreciated the break. And they had much more productive hearings when people weren't so tired, so angry, so frustrated after waiting hours to be heard.
If you just think about that stress system and what's happening to the stress system, I mean, I've been to court for a speeding ticket and was so stressed out, and that had nothing to do with my child, right? Like, I wasn't feeling threatened by anything. I mean, the worst thing that was going to happen is I was going to have to pay a ticket, or, you know what I mean? Like, it's so low bar compared to what these families are showing up for court for. And then we're saying, gather together with all kinds of people that have similar stressors, and then let's just lock in, right? And you're going to be here for 4 or 5 hours because, you know, we serve at the schedule of the court, right? Like, this is all that we're going to do. And then, like you said, on the flip side of that, by doing that staggering, like, A, the families don't have to experience that stress, which is only going to carry out throughout the day, right? Like, until they can actually move their bodies or do what they need to do to regulate. But I think about that courtroom staff who truthfully, until this moment, I've never thought about them as being, you know, in that pressure cooker too, because of course, that means they're probably in their downstairs brain, which means we get downstairs brain behavior from them, which becomes a combative situation. And so to even say, like, you know, get up and take a walk. We got 10 minutes before the next one starts. And like, what a huge gift that is. And I think through efficiencies as well. And so I actually imagine they probably actually see more cases because they're dealing with less, like, quote unquote, behavior management and dysregulation. So, wow, that's a great tip. And it seems like I don't schedule for courts, but it doesn't seem like it would be too terribly burdensome to adjust to that type of scheduling.
It's definitely possible. So if we talk about connecting, you know, the core of TBRI is this connection. And oftentimes I would hear from legal professionals, I'm not a caregiver. I don't have an ongoing relationship with the person I'm serving. How would that possibly work in my line of work? I've seen changes happen in two ways. One pattern that I've seen with attorneys, and especially attorneys that are serving, that are public defenders, they have a really heavy caseload. They have a lot of cases with a similar fact pattern. There were times that I met a client right before hearing, 1 or 2 minutes before walking into a hearing. And when I did that as an attorney, my client did not trust me. They perceived me as just another piece of the machine that was there to take away something really powerful. And so scheduling, and I know that pushes on that efficiency piece, but 10 minutes to just hear about their lives and hear about what is the most important thing I need to hear from you. I know this from the file. I know the law. I know the facts, but you tell me what's important to you, and giving voice. I didn't do that as an attorney. I really showed up as, I'm the expert. I'm here to help you. Please just go along with my plan. So that is one way that as an attorney, you could approach it. I've also seen judges take the first 5 minutes of a hearing and use that as relational time. And what that can look like is getting to know this child, this youth that's in front of you. What is their favorite sports team? And then, you know, a judge being mindful of that. Hey, did you see the game last night? There was a judge who learned this child's favorite thing was poetry. And so at every hearing, and this was a child welfare case where the child was coming in at a fairly regular frequency, the judge would say, do you have a poem for me? And of course, the child had a poem. And of course, the child was delighted to just hear and see the judge take an interest. I have seen, Sarah, judges get off the bench. So that's just the raised, elevated desk that they have, take off their robes. They have real business clothes underneath that. But a lot of times kids don't know that. And they come down and they sit at a round table. And so instead of being up high and with the gavel, they are eye level, face to face. And it really feels like you're a human and I'm a human. And it takes away that putting the judge on the pedestal that does feel very scary. And we've seen really, really productive conversations and hearings when judges take simple steps like that to build connection.
Isn't that interesting? When I worked in adoptions years ago, there was one attorney that in the like questionnaire for the family asked about the kid's like kind of favorite interests or whatever. And so at the adoption, she would show up with like a balloon with Paw Patrol on it, or like a little tiny Lego set, or you know, something that, I mean, you know, we all know she didn't go out. Like she had somebody, her assistant, doing these things, or she had a closet she felt, you know, kept stuff in, or whatever she did. But I can remember those kids lighting up, because even in the adoption court, which is a huge celebration, it's still full of stress, right? And just that moment to connect. And I kept watching that and thinking, like, we're missing this earlier. Right. We're missing this type of thing earlier. And it could be a coloring page, right? Like it could be so little to have just a small investment of like, I heard you like Spider-Man. Have you seen this cool coloring page? Or, you know, if you want to color while we're doing this or something, just to help with, you know, any sensory needs or overwhelm or stress or, you know, whatever. And it doesn't feel cumbersome, but to me, the hardest part is the mind shift. Right. I'm a judge. I sit on the bench. I have my robe. I have my gavel. This is how we do this thing, into the space of like, back to what you said at the beginning, which was, what are our goals? Like, what do we really want for these people? Because we are serving them. Right? We are here to serve these people. And if we want this family to be successful, or if we want this kid to, you know, graduate whatever program they're in successfully, and in my mind, and I might have some grandiose thinking, but I think these are the places where we impact prison systems and homelessness and things like this for adults, because this is where we have this moment to capture these kids and show them that even in this particular place that has always been perceived to be scary, that you can find safe adults, right? And it's magical when it happens, because then they show up with a poem. Like, what is that? Like, that doesn't even calculate in my head for kids' experiences with the court. That is really beautiful. Talk to me a little bit. I am going to swing back to empowering real quick, because we've seen courtrooms or courthouses where they've dedicated like entire spaces to meeting the sensory needs of the kids and having calm down space and all that. But I'm a brand new courthouse doing this. I'm in the basement of this building. I don't have an extra room to do anything like that. I might be lucky to have a little basket in the corner. Like, how would you encourage, again, back to that, like, we're just starting out. Like, my judge isn't bought into this whole idea of a sensory room, you know, or a calm down space. How would you encourage people just starting out to think through that lens of meeting some of those sensory needs and the empowering principles, or even snacks and water or things like that? Like, within the small budget, do you have any recommendations for people to try to make some of those changes?
I do. And I would not wait for a space to try implementing TBRI, because really you can have a backpack that is full of a lot of different options. Sarah, you mentioned food and water, and a lot of the misbehavior, what adults would term misbehavior, aggression, disrespect, there is a substantial percentage of that that is just a body who is saying, I am dehydrated and I'm hungry. And so that, I would always have options. I would have water. I would have a sweet snack. I would have a salty snack, a crunchy. I know there are people that go to the food bank and they're like, we don't have a budget for this, but we are going to go ask our local food bank to help supply this. We are going to ask a faith community, will you supply us and do this? I would have some fidgets, some manipulatives for kids. We ask kids to sit still for a really long time, and that is an adult expectation that I don't think is reasonable. I have, Sarah, a hard time sitting still in a meeting that's more than 30 minutes long. And so having fidgets that they can move their body in a way that is not disruptive to other people. I would think about weighted items, and that could be a weighted stuffed animal, a little lap pad. Any kind of weighted item brings what we call proprioceptive input. It is like a hug. It is a very calming experience for most people. I would consider putting in some essential oils. And again, I would find somebody that is their gift to the community and say, will you please supply me with lavender, with peppermint? We know lavender can be calming. Peppermint can be alerting. There's other wonderful ones that kind of bring a calming, balancing option. And I would have choices for kids. Mm-hmm. I would think about maybe...
On the essential oil, Scott Waters has told us the story of how they had almost like a pill bottle size, a little reusable bottle with a screw top on it. And they would put drops of essential oil on cotton balls and put them in there. And then the kids could just, you know, take the lid off and smell it. And it's such a small investment. You just throw the cotton ball out and you can, you know, recycle, and you're not like pouring the whole bottle of oils out. So just another like efficiency in that way.
Absolutely. Of these little things that will have a big impact. There are courts that have lava lamps. Again, if a child can't move, but they can look at something, it's fun. It's novel. It's fascinating. Lava lamps usually aren't in scary places. And so this element of, we are here to do business, and I understand you don't want to be here. I understand this is hard emotionally, physically for you. However, we're going to do this together, and I'm going to do my best to support you. And so a lava lamp, there's a courtroom in Mississippi that is connected with their local Rotary Club, and they have a library nook that has soft lighting, a little bean bag. Kids can go and look at books if they need to move during a hearing, and they get to take a book with them. And the Rotary Club, that is their give, is to support that. And so thinking through things you could have in a backpack, there are times, I will say, Sarah, kids need to fidget. and fidgets might not be allowed in court. That's a pretty big leap for a court. It pushes up against traditional values of courtroom decorum, and that's the practice of law is based on history, laws that have been made in the past, cases that have happened in the past. And so there really is a tension there when we do something that is not in line with what's been done with the past. But there are attorneys who know this judge won't allow the youth I'm serving to use fidgets. Bubblegum or a lollipop, those things can be very calming and comforting. Those aren't allowed in the courtroom. However, they have their briefcase full of books, and it's a heavy weight that they can just put on the child's lap if they're realizing you need a weighted item here. There are attorneys that practice breathing exercises with their clients before they go in, or they'll practice a chair push-up or pull-up. And so these are things that people can do in court when they're feeling stressed, and they don't require any equipment. And they have a tremendous just ability to bring people back to a calm space. And we know when the body is calm, they can access their upstairs brain. Everything will go better for everyone. And so we just have some really creative people who are innovators and are getting it done no matter what the budget.
Isn't that incredible? I love all those examples because literally, like, here's my briefcase. Here's my backpack. You want to wear my backpack today? Here, let's do some, breathing before we go in. If you're in there and you get dysregulated, you can pull up on your chair. Right? Like, you can maintain decorum by just pulling on your chair. Nobody has to know what you're doing. It's not like wildly fidgety or no bright toys or anything like that, or, fidgets. Okay. Let's try to do one thing about correcting in the courtroom. And I think, with all the stress of the court, with all the, I just keep coming back to, what is that nervous system is probably just on fire and things don't always go well. And so can you give us, an example of how a judge might manage something, some level of dysregulation or, a child hitting a fear response pre and post TBRI?
Yes. I will say pre, courts, what we have been trained to do, what we know to do is this idea of maintaining decorum. We rely on the judge to set the tone. If someone is becoming dysregulated and we would, if angry behavior, disrespectful, belligerent, there's a bailiff in the courtroom. It's an armed officer of the court who oftentimes steps in or would move towards that person. And there would be some, there might be language like, if you can't calm down, this bailiff is going to help you. Or if you are not able to calm down, this hearing is done and we won't take your viewpoint into consideration. We have many things to do. And judges, they have a tremendous load. They cannot just reschedule hearings on a whim. Two practices I've seen done by just two stunning judges. One, this judge talked about not understanding people are coming in, they are angry, they are frustrated, they are hurting, and not expecting them to use their best words and most respectful manner. She doesn't take that disrespect personally. She doesn't let it land. And so she doesn't become dysregulated. She will allow the parents a minute to express themselves, whatever that is. And then she will say, I understand. And I would feel that way as well. And here is what I am here to do for you and with you. Would you participate in this? She gives voice, she empathizes, and then she really sets a tone of, we're here to figure this out together. I would like you to partner with me in that. It's
I just think, like, I don't know. I didn't, this is not the outside of the courtroom, right? Like, me learning to be like that with kids, it took so much mindfulness and so much attention to, like, why would I have this like great expectation that on a dime, this dysregulated kid can respect me, right? Like that was a real deal. That is how I was raised. And that's how I started working with kids until I learned TBRI. And I just imagine like, I'm like, you know, a very young adult working in residential, trying to, you know, boss these kids around that are taller than me and demanding all this respect. My position is not that of judge, right? Where like the position alone sort of demands that respect, right? And so then to have a judge that's like, just that level of humility for that position is just, it's just mind blowing. I just love it so much. Yeah.
It's unbelievable, Sarah. And yeah. I hear, you know, this again and again. There was another judge that said, there are things that I do sometimes that don't feel great. There is this human element that when mm-hmm. we're attacked, we want to respond. And this judge tells himself, but that's not going to give me the results that I want. And I care Ooh. More about results than being right or feeling mm-hmm. justified in a moment. Mm-hmm. One of the practices this judge uses is if there's dysregulation, he will say, I'm going to let you stop. I'm going to give you 10 minutes to go do a walk and a talk outside with your attorney. If you'd like to come back and try it again, you are welcome to. But sets a boundary. This kind of talk isn't respectful. This isn't going to get you anywhere, but gives the opportunity for movement, breath, space, a co-regulator, if that attorney can help the person come down, and then let's try it again without needing to reference and go back to the first episode that was less than ideal. And so this is a judge giving redos in court.
Well, it's just incredible. It's just incredible. I have one more question I want to ask. I know we've kind of come to time, but if you worked in a court where the judge was not on board, right? Because it seems like it seems pretty pivotal to have the judge on board. How would you encourage, CASA attorney, guardian ad litem, like how would you encourage those professionals that like so desperately want to see this for the kids that they serve? How would you encourage them to bring just a dose of education to the judge and in such a way that it'll be received?
That's a great question. I have seen, and I would call these maybe court adjacent organizations or people, the thing that these organizations have that is courts often don't is time to work on this and think about this, resources to come and partner. So many of these programs, instead of coming and saying, court, you need to fill in the blank XYZ, I'll tell you, a judge is a judge because they don't get ordered around anymore. But right. This idea of what do you need and how can I support you? And so is that snacks? Is that a library? And sometimes that is, I don't need anything physically from you. I need somebody, and it can't be the court, to train bio parents, foster parents, adoptive parents, anyone in the court system at these levels. Oftentimes the core root is trauma that got them to whatever situation that brought them into court. And so I've seen a lot of fantastic organizations say, we will serve our community by teaching TBRI at a regular cadence. You don't have to wait a long time to jump into that. It is free. It is accessible. Thinking through things like, you know, is there a place for the children to be? You know, if it's in the evening, are meals provided so people can really come and receive? And so asking that question, not walking into a court and saying, this is what you need to do, because we see the implementation starting point for each project is different, and it's based on the needs of the community. And so when you're able to partner with a court like that and say, let me go find grants for that calming studio, let me go find a grant to hire someone to be teaching TBRI regularly. Mm-hmm. Let me supply you with an unlimited amount of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches so no one is ever hungry in your courtroom. There are a lot of ways to serve, and it is a community problem. It requires a community response. The courts alone cannot solve this problem, we see tremendous positive change for communities when there are multiple organizations surrounding and working mm-hmm. in connection with the courts.
Yeah, man, that's so good. I want to also point our listeners to All Rise for the Good of the Children, which is an awesome resource about TBRI in the courts in Tyler, Texas, with the team down there. And then again, our show notes, if we've mentioned other resources, we'll have those available in the show notes. Carrie Dady, thank you. You are a treasure, and I'm so glad I get to work with you.
Thank you, Sarah. Can I tell you one more story?
Please.
There is a judge. This judge is in Georgia. This judge is beginning to implement TBRI. This court is focused on survivors of sexual trafficking. So the youth coming through her court have substantial trauma histories. The way that the judge interacts with these youth who are in her court is so full of all of these elements of connection, of giving voice, of I see you, that, and this is unbelievable, but when these kids are on elopement, they still call into their hearings because they want to talk to the judge. They put her name on their list of visitors for jail because, and she can't go see them at jail. There are so many reasons why
she
can't. But we were having a conversation, Darren and I, a couple months ago with this fantastic human. And she said, I'm not quite sure why this is happening, but she had story after story. And Darren and I looked at each other and we were like, we do. You have become an attachment figure. You have become a safe place and a safe harbor. And so instead of this really industrial process that usually people avoid at all costs, these kids are seeking out your attention because you listen and they know you care. And it's just so beautiful. But little movements, there are just resistors and world changers spread across the courts in this country who are bringing TBRI to their communities, and it's beautiful.
The TBRI podcast is produced by the Care and Purpose Institute of Child Development at TCU. To learn more about TBRI and the resources mentioned in this episode, please visit child.tcu.edu/podcast.